Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, members, if we could come to order. We're a little shy of a majority, but we're a little shy anyway, so we can begin just the same. Representative Mallory, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome back, I guess I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I see there's a reverse crew now. The last two times I was in this committee, Representative Benson was in the chair, and he said, somebody, Howard said there was a crew.
I wrenched the gavel back from him earlier this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The chair will move House File 1209 to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, this is a follow-up on our legislation from a few years ago. I think it was Representative Westerberg that carried the bill for trying to get at the equity stripping, and in fact, we have one of the leading provisions in the country, according to some of the state, like NCSL and things like that, on this issue. It was the issue of when somebody is got problems with their house paying for it, somebody unscrupulous comes in, gets them to sign over a deed, and then they give them back a lease or something like that, where they obviously can't pay it, and then they kick them out of the house right afterwards. So they've got the equity stripper takes all of the equity in the house, and the other person gets nothing out of it. And we stopped that, except we left some loopholes. And one of the loopholes is that the equity stripper can put them in a different house and get around the present law. So he can, if he owns two houses, he can avoid our law by putting them in the other house. We wanted to make it okay for instance, people that were prior friends or relatives to do this. So that's in there. We also wanted to close the loophole that required that you do, I think it was two within a year or something like that, so that if you rip off somebody really bad, you don't even get a free shot at it. If you take all of their equity in their house, you're liable under the law, just as if you'd done ripped off two people. And then another part is, if they're kicking you out right now, you have no way to stop the eviction. You know, they've gone to you, fraudulently got you to transfer your interest in the property to them. They gave you back a lease, and you can't pay it. They can kick you out, and you have no way to stop from getting kicked out on the unlawful detainer. So this would require a judge to put a stay on that unlawful detainer until that can be heard in court. And there's certain affidavits that are required by the defendant who was kicked out of his house in order to get this. And then there's a penalty if those are fraudulent and it turns out in the long run. So that's what this bill does, yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We have, looks like witnesses.
Yes.
Who's up first? Good morning, Mr. Elwood. Welcome back. Please introduce yourself and the chair and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid, and I don't have much to add to Representative Mullery's characterization of the bill, except for the fact that the other thing the bill does, very importantly, is to remove the 2009 sunset that was placed on the bill when it was initially passed in 2004. And the reason we're doing that is because, as Representative Mullery pointed out, this has become a model law in the nation. It's been replicated in many other states, several other states, and we have found that it has actually worked precisely as it was intended. It got rid of the worst offenders. It allows legitimate transactions to take place, and it provides the tools to borrowers or consumers, homeowners, who continue to be scammed by some of these unscrupulous operators that continue to operate in the marketplace. So we would appreciate your support and passing this bill on to the Commerce Committee. Mm-hmm. And with that, I would ask our other witness to come on up.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Welcome to the committee, and would you introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Amber Hawkins. I'm also with Legal Aid. I was a staff attorney with Legal Aid for approximately 7 years, working on a lot of cases like these, assisting homeowners who had been in foreclosure and who had been subject to one of these transactions. Mm-hmm. In early 2004, Legal Aid partnered with the Volunteer Lawyers Network in Hennepin County, and we started a task force. We were seeing so many of these. We started a task force for attorneys to gather and help each other handle these cases because they're incredibly complex, and we didn't have this law at the time. So that task force has continued until today. There are approximately 25 members of the task force, private attorneys, sole practitioners, and attorneys from law firms, Legal Aid folks, and some other people from the industry, from the real estate industry, who just want to help. The recommendations for this bill came from the task force, from their experiences in working on these cases and seeing where some of the problems were. So the members of the task force would appreciate passage of this legislation. And with that, if anyone has questions about the issues or cases, I can certainly answer them. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Hollis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Elwood. Bottom of page 4. The post office box does not constitute a physical address. The city of Walker does not have mail delivered to any homes within the city. They all have post office boxes. What can we do about this? Many other cities in my district are the same.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Representative House, the intent of this was to try to avoid the situation where somebody is kind of, you know, just operating unscrupulously, just not having any kind of a physical presence in a business. My question to you would be, although mail is delivered to a post office box, I mean, folks would obviously, I mean, businesses have addresses, physical addresses. Is that not correct?
Representative Hollis.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Elwood, they may, and they probably do, but maybe between now and the next committee you could combine it with something, if their legal address is a post office box, that to get their mail through, you could include the street, you know, somehow work the language so it takes care of those cities that have that problem.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, that was a contingency that we hadn't thought of. So, we'd be happy to figure out a way to address that situation. I guess if you can't get mail at an address, then we have to figure this out. So, we'll work on that. And thank you for raising the issue.
Any other questions? Representative Moore.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Howes, I don't think this is... There's an awful lot of parts of our statutes and court rules where we use this same type of language, and I don't think we've figured it out exactly the best method for any... I mean, there's hundreds of things that are done that way. I don't know if we're going to be able to figure out a new way just for this bill that's different from all the other similar notices that are required under the laws we passed.
Mr. Howell, Representative Howell.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, something has to be fixed because on page 7 we've got the same thing. Provided at a minimum the contract and the notice of cancellation must contain a physical address to which notice of cancellation may be mailed. Well, you can't do that. In Walker, now the DMV had a problem with this 2 years ago
because of the Patriot Act when you got your driver's license. And if I lived in the city of Walker and I had my post office box there, DMV would not mail it to a post office box because of the Patriot Act. They wanted to actually go to a residence or a person that would actually pick it up from a fixed location. So what DMV did is they changed the way the driver's licenses are filled out. So it would be Larry Howes, 5340 Lady Slipper, Post Office Box 19. So they included both a physical address and a post office box in their mailing address. So that's what you have to do. That covers...
Representative Howes, we should look into on this bill then before it gets any further.
Yeah,
probably a lot of areas of our statutes should be looked into too.
They should not, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Representative Scalzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe as a little bit of a background, there are some cities in the metro area that don't have mail delivery service either. I know of one city in particular, but they all have an address, particularly for fire service. Because otherwise the firefighters don't know which house to go to. They can't go to a post office box. So everybody has an address. And whether or not they get their mail delivered there, as Representative Howes said, you know, the post office box could be combined with the address, but everybody does have an address.
Very good point.
Representative
Scalzi.
Any other questions? Is there anyone else who would wish to testify either for or against this bill?
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I forgot to point out the Pat Sexton from the Commerce Department told me Friday that he didn't think he'd make it this morning, but wanted me to put in that they have no objection to the bill, and also the Attorney General's office supports it.
Thank you, Representative Murray. Seeing no one else who wishes to testify, I will move House File 1209 to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Oh, come on, ladies and gentlemen. I was here at 11 last night, and I'm twice your age. Come on. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed. Thank you, Representative. Right. All right. Representative Dabney's not here. Representative Hortenstein. Olin. Holberg, Atkins.
I can go up and get older.
Get one of them, will you? Drag them in here.
Mr. Chairman, we don't need them here to move and kill the bill, do we?
We do not, actually.
Then I would make them.
Move and killing bills every chance we can get.
Too many bills.
All right, I understand we have a quorum, and so can we get, let's see, Representative Scalzi, would you move the minutes, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move the minutes of March 16th.
Thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? So approved.
Mr. Chairman, as long as we have some downtime.
Yes, sir.
Could you check with Representative Dabney to find out if he has committee scheduled for Friday?
Okay, I will. We do not at the present, apparently.
The week's looking better already, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, it is. Representative Owen, welcome. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Do you have someone to move your bill?
I'll move this bill, sir.
All right.
Okay.
Representative Nelson moves House File 1053 to be passed and moved referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Welcome, Representative Holland. I don't know if you want me to proceed today or if you want me to wait till I can actually get the Attorney General's here, because this notice got to me after I had already left for baptism over the weekend. So the Attorney General's office didn't get notice, and it's actually their bill I'm carrying.
Mm.
So, from a logistic point of view, I don't know which, if you want me just to proceed to tell you what I can tell you about it, then I can do so.
Yes, let's do that.
Okay.
We're running out of time.
Well, basically what we've got here is we're requesting that if a computer is stolen, no matter what the value of the computer is, that it be turned into a felony under the criminal statutes. If the computer would have any identity information on it, in its memory about the owner or any other person. As we're mostly aware, the computers nowadays probably inadvertently have social security numbers and all sorts of other things included in a felony or in a computer that gets stolen from somebody's house or somewhere else, and this statute would make it a felony if you stole that computer, because that computer may be able to be used in the identity theft efforts elsewhere by getting that information. So that's essentially what the bill does.
Representative Olin, how does this compare to someone stealing some other paper documentation that may have those private information, or one's purse or one's billfold? Saying I had my coat jacket sitting on a chair, I was in a restaurant, and someone comes by and looks.
I would compare, in all honesty, the way I would see it compare, as of now, the purse or any with identity information in it would still be covered by whatever value was actually stolen, so the dollar sign value would still control, and this computer would become a felony, whereas the purse situation, if you steal a credit card, may not be. Unless there's another bill floating around that I haven't seen.
Well, Representative Rose, but what if you had in your bill fold your Social Security card, for example, and
you'd have the same situation. I've seen that happen as paying a county attorney back in the olden days.
Same situation as what?
As a stolen straight theft of a purse may not turn into an automatic felony, as this statute would for computer the way it's written.
Representative Hollis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Olin, we might have to have staff answer this question, but I'll ask you. You have as defined in Section 609.87, Subdivision 3. How broad is that definition? Would it include like a BlackBerry or... Now we've got some of these phones that have got tons of information on it. I think my granddaughter just got one. It's way out of my league, but...
Unfortunately, Representative Zendrolman. Mr. Chairman, Representative Howes, unfortunately, since I was relying on the Attorney Generals to be here and they're not here, I can't specifically tell you in that statute in a quick hurry. They may be able to find it quicker than I can, because I didn't have a chance to look at that statute, because I didn't even realize it was going to come until I came into the office this morning.
Mr. Panter, maybe assist us.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hollis, the definition of computer used there, it's pretty short, I'll just read it. Computer means an electronic device which performs logical, arithmetic, or memory functions by the manipulation of signals, including but not limited to electronic or magnetic impulses. Got it?
Well, Mr. Chairman, was that done by an attorney to keep it vague so we can't understand it?
I suspect. Representative Howes, in all honesty, after listening to that, I'm not sure it was even drawn up by an attorney. Because it is a vague definition.
Representative Owen, can you characterize what the Attorney General's testifier would say said to you? Have you had communication with them as to whether they support the bill? Or?
They support the bill, yes, and this is part of their all-out effort to make identity theft a more serious situation, and this is just one little piece of that overall effort that they have. I'm guessing
Mr. Chairman, that this bill would end up being forwarded to the property committee because there's a penalty provision, or into public safety, and because of the penalty provisions, and you may just want to forward it there and let public safety, I think this will make that determination.
It
would have been right now.
Oh, so very good.
Just welcome to the committee. You are divining what you were thinking as you were walking through the door. So, do you introduce yourself? And welcome, by the way, to the committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ben Wadsman with the Attorney General's Office. Where were we at?
Representative Olin has given a brief description of what the bill's intent is, its content and intent, and we're now wanting to find out from you whether you agree.
Sure. Well, essentially, and I don't think it's a surprise to anybody that identity theft is a huge problem in the United States and in Minnesota. It's been on the rise in the past 3 years, according to the FTC data that we've seen. This bill essentially makes it a crime, or makes it, excuse me, a felony, punishable as a felony, to steal a computer with identity information. The fact of the matter is that these computers oftentimes contain information that's much more damaging and much more useful to thieves than just the laptop itself, which may only be worth, you know, a couple hundred bucks in some cases. Say you're a college student, it's like a car, you know, as soon as you buy it, appreciates half when you take it off a lot. So it's difficult for prosecutors to get up to the $500 threshold for felony in some cases. So this basically just brings it up to that threshold, as we've done with some other property.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Any questions from the panel? Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I have to ask Representative House's question about, does that include like a BlackBerry or a Palm Pilot or something like that that might have that similar information? Would that be fall into that same type of thing as a computer? Mm-hmm. From what we read out of the statute, it sounds like it would, but get your opinion on that.
That would be my understanding. I'd have to double check on the definition in statute, but I believe so.
We've read the statute here and
yeah.
Sure. Any other questions from the panel? Is there anyone else here who would wish to speak or testify in favor or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Olin, do you have a comment or a final summary?
I think Mr. Chairman, I think I would recommend that you just send it to public safety because of the felony provisions in it, because I think it has to go there.
Representative Olin, you have to send it to Commerce first, I guess. So. All right, seeing no other discussion, Mr. Nelson, Representative Nelson moves House File 1053 to be passed and referred to Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you, Representative Olin.
Thank you.
I think I saw Representative Hornstein in here.
Yeah, you're right.
Can we hear your bill next?
Sure.
Oh, you are here. I'm sorry. Welcome, Representative Hornstein. You introduce yourself.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Representative Frank Hornstein from District 60B in Southwest Minneapolis. I wanted to move an amendment to the bill, but I wanted to get your advice about where we go. I think up to maybe the full committee, the Labor and Commerce Committee, would be my understanding.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, well, let me move the bill first, and then, or have someone move the bill first, and then have someone move a DE1 amendment.
You can do it yourself.
It's Monday morning. It's Monday morning. If it's not transportation, I assume I'm not on the committee. Okay. Mr. Chair, I would like to move House File 1224 for passage and then re-referral to the Commerce Committee.
Representative Hornstein moves House File 1224 to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Welcome. And
thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to also move the DE1 amendment. It has some technical changes to the bill, make it closer to what we'd like to ultimately see. It's a DE1. I'd right. like to move it.
Representative Hornstein moves DE1 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. House File 1224, its origins come from a labor dispute that took place with an employer in my district, and with an employer that did receive a fair amount of public money, and in that situation was actively discouraging union organizing. And so originally this bill was drafted a couple years ago, had not received a hearing, and so we've updated it a bit and basically lays out some mainly accounting practices to ensure that public monies are not used to either encourage or discourage union organizing. This is not a role for public money, and particularly we have a lot of grants. In this case, the employer was a nonprofit, but of course there's also other forms of public money to many kinds of employees. So to go through the bill, I have Brad Lato from the Minnesota AFL-CIO, and he can talk a little bit more about the specifics of the bill, but I wanted to give you some background about why I'm here and what we hope this bill will accomplish.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Lato. If you give your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, my name is Brad Lato, Legislative Director for the Minnesota AFL-CIO. Thank you for allowing me to be here, and thank you to Representative Hornstein for carrying the legislation. I also want to acknowledge Representative Mullery, who has a similar bill also to the amendment that he's been working as well on the issue. As Representative Hornstein mentioned, the origin of the bill is where we often see the situation as with Walker Methodist Health Center, where employers get or receive public funds and then oppose organizing efforts. And what the bill basically says, and it's modeled on a bill that passed from California and New York, and it's been tweaked, and that's what the amendment does since that time, since those bills passed. It basically requires employers to say they're not going to use the public money for that they want it. They don't have to take the public money. If they want the public money, they have to say they're not going to use it for or against organizing. And with that portion of the money, they just have to remain neutral. Any other money they have, any other monies that they have, can be used for or against organizing efforts as they see fit. They just have to keep track. And the bill doesn't say how they have to keep records, doesn't prescribe how they keep the records. Whatever works best for their system, their record-keeping system, is okay. So as if they just have to have that. It also has, and of course, it'll have to go to a number of committees. It also has investigatory abilities by the Department of Labor and Industry and the Attorney General, and penalties as well if it's used. I know that opponents will say that the Minnesota Legislature cannot do this because it's going to be preempted under the National Labor Relations Act. In fact, the California law was originally thrown out in a state court. However, the Ninth District Court of Appeals has ruled that it is not preempted under the National Labor Relations Act or federal law or the First Amendment. In fact, the judge in the case said, the presiding judge, we hold that California's grant and program fund restrictions do not undermine federal labor policy and are not preempted by the NLRA, National Labor Relations Act, and do not violate the First Amendment. And that opinion was filed September 21st in 2006. an example would be here, is if you had money granted to a hospital to create more nurse positions. This, you know, and the state doesn't want the effectiveness of its grants diminished by funding a campaign to convince nurses to unionize or not to unionize. So long as the hospitals remain free to lobby nurses with their own monies, California, Minnesota, New York, any other state that passes within its rights, since the grants be used for the purpose which they were given, the creation of nursing positions. That actual example was cited by the judge, presiding judge, or the judge that made the opinion in California. Section one of the bill contains all the definitions, and that's, and the difference between the current bill and this is that it's much more specific. And like I said, it was based on the California law, the court decision, and trying to address some of the dissenting judges' concerns with the bill. Employer influence activity is described in page one of the bill, section one, subdivision two, which cites what activities an employer would later be prohibited from on page three of the bill. Public funds are described there, as I said, the bill requires on page three, section three, an employer taking public money to certify that they will not use those monies, and only those monies, for the employer influence activities, which again is defined as opposing unionizing efforts. There are exceptions in the bill, and exceptions including other federal or state laws that might take effect, or collective bargaining agreements, grievances, negotiating collective bargaining agreements, that sort of thing. As I said, the last section six outlines investigatory actions and enforcement actions. Some would say, by the way, the California opinion was is now, there's a petition to the Supreme Court, to the United States Supreme Court, to hear the action. Some would say we should wait on this legislation to get the Supreme Court decision, or see if the Supreme Court agrees to hear the bill. I guess we would attend that the Minnesota legislature should never wait to protect the taxpayers' money to be used what it's intended to. The other thing is this bill is going to have a lot of committee stops. Whether it gets through this deadline or not, moving the bill closer to the House and Senate floors would put Minnesota in a position to more quickly pass a bill if the Supreme Court should hear rule on the California law, or agree or decide not to hear on anything. That would be my testimony, and I'd be happy to answer any questions whatsoever. Thank you.
Mr. Rangel, are there any questions from the panel? Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hornstein, on page two, and I know we don't do finance in this committee, but since there's a blank dollar amount there, could you give me a guesstimation as to what that dollar amount might be?
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, Representative House, we had talked about $25,000, but I'll let Mr. Leto expound on how we came up with that figure.
Mr. Leto.
Mr. Chair, Representative Howells, the California law has different amounts, and there's been starting with $10,000, and I would like an opportunity to look better at the technical services contract language. We thought if we had to put in an amount here, my thought would be $25,000, but we could certainly, whether it needs to be another amount, we're certainly amenable to that.
Representative Hollis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Hornstein, just make sure you get that hospital that we're all thinking of.
Excuse me, I said.
Just make sure you cover that hospital that hasn't been built yet, but we know what we're that hospital.
Okay.
Make sure you get it out in time to cover that one.
Okay.
Any other questions from the panel? Is there anyone who would wish to speak for or against the bill? Careful there.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Dave Dietrichs with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and thank you for this opportunity to testify today on House File 1224. The Chamber opposes this legislation, and actually you've heard many of the reasons why from the previous testifiers why we oppose this legislation. The Chamber believes this is an area that's already covered by federal law, because it would substantially affect the bargaining process, and it would have a chilling effect on employer speech. And the previous testifier was correct. This law has been petitioned to be heard by the United States Supreme Court. It was heard and ruled upon by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in California, but it actually only was ruled upon, as Mr. Leto stated, after its third attempt. The first two times this bill was heard, it was ruled preempted and by a panel of Ninth Circuit judges saying that it was preempted by two United States Supreme Court cases which govern federal law in this area. And so we believe that this is an area of federal law that needs to be resolved. Specifically, these 15 other states currently have similar legislation like this right now, and the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision is in direct conflict with the Second Circuit and the Seventh Circuit. So we believe that there's going to need to be some resolution there. The Chamber is also concerned about why the state should be able to tell an employer how to use money they have received or earned, sometimes for services performed for the state. The Chamber is also concerned how this could be problematic when there are jurisdictional disputes between unions, sometimes across state lines. Among other things, this bill would apply to funds received by employers in competitive bid contracts, payments made to health providers, and reimbursements for services performed. Again, the Chamber believes this is an area, at least of law that as applied to our members, is covered by federal law and preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. With that, I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Any questions from the Representative Dabney?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dietrichs, I'm surprised that it appears that the Chamber's position is that tax dollars shouldn't be used for the purchase of services and goods, but instead should be able to be used for engaging in other activities that the public, frankly, didn't pay for.
Mr. Dietrichs.
Can you clarify for me, please, your last statement?
Mr. Dietrichs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, if I understand your question correctly, I believe that what you're asking is if money that's been appropriated by the state to employers can be used to discourage unionized activities. I believe that's what you're asking. Is that correct?
Mr. Dabney?
It seems to me that what should happen is the state contracts with for-profit or non-profit organization X for the purchase of certain goods and services. We're buying furniture, we're purchasing health care, we're doing something, mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing a downside to saying that's where the state's money begins and ends.
Mm-hmm.
That we buy the furniture, we're not paying the company to then take public funds and do other things with them, we're buying furniture. Mm-hmm. And it seems the Chamber's position is that we should be spending taxpayers' dollars not only to buy furniture, but to provide the company with funds to interfere with the rights of their employees.
Mr. Dietrichs.
In fact, using the employees' own tax dollars to interfere then with their rights to unionize.
Mr. Dietrichs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, I apologize if I misspoke. What I was trying to state was that after an employer has performed services and therefore received state funds for the performance of those services, the employer should be able to use those funds as they see fit. And if that means that they can discourage unionization, which is an 8C protected right under the National Labor Relations Act, then we believe the employer should be able to use those funds as they see appropriate.
Mr. Dietrichs, does that mean we're overpaying these people?
Mr. Dietrichs.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney.
Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have similar concerns, and I guess as the question is going on here, there's all sorts of places where we give public money, anywhere from food stamps to other things, that we have restrictions on individuals that they can't. So if you get food stamps, you can't buy that, spend that money on multiple things. You're restricted on what you can spend that on. How is this different from those situations.
Mr. Dietrichs.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, the Chamber is concerned that in certain situations when an employer receives money that they would, therefore, under this law, should it be passed, be prohibited from exercising protected rights that they have under the National Labor Relations Act.
Representative Nelson.
Okay.
Any other questions from the panel? Representative Schimansky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Dewey. A contractor signs contract with the state to provide a good or service. In that process of delivery, they've delivered the product or the service. The funds, are they still state funds, or are they the corporation's funds at that point? Mr. Dietrichs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, those are the corporation's funds at that point.
And at that point, would the Mr. Schimansky corporation then be entitled to use those funds as they see appropriate?
Mr. Dietrichs.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, they would.
Thank you. Any other questions from me? Is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Mr. Hornstein, Representative Hornstein, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to renew my motion to have House File 1224 as amended pass and be referred to the Commerce Committee.
Commerce and Labor Committee, thank you. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
No. No.
Pass.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair members.
Representative Dabney. Welcome back to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Dabney and former chair. Could you give your name for the record, please?
Representative Jim Dabney. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 1758 before the committee, recommended to pass and be referred to the Commerce and, the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Representative Dabney moves House File 1758 to be passed and be referred to Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Mr. Chair, I have two amendments, one in the packet and one short oral amendment. At this point, I'd like to move the AO70304 amendment, which should be in members' packets, to get the bill in the form of which I wish.
Representative Dabney moves amendment A070304. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Secondly, Mr. Chair, on page 1, line 15 of the bill, I have a short oral amendment. After the word CHIP, insert the words OR A MAGNETIC STRIPE. Again, page 1, line 15, after the word CHIP, OR A MAGNETIC Strike.
Representative Dabney moves an oral amendment on line 1.15. Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, if you're wondering what an access device is, this is what they look like. We know that Representative Peterson, nothing says love like plastic. many of us use them much of the time, perhaps too much of the time. I'm putting mine away. 2 years ago, I worked very closely. No, Representative Gunther. 2 years ago, I worked very closely with then Representative Jeff Johnson to pass legislation here in Minnesota to protect consumers and require that in the cases of a security breach, if an organization had your data, your bank, retailers, so on, and that security was breached, whether it was a hacker getting into a server or someone walking into the store and grabbing a pile of receipts, that you were notified when that breach occurred so that you could judge the risk and take precautions
as you saw fit. What I didn't have an appreciation of at that time was a problem that individuals and organizations in the financial services industry have talked to me actually about for several years now, and that House File 1758 is an expression of. And that is merchants who, in violation of their Visa contract, hold on to your data. And what happens is Company X, don't want to name any names, will hold on to your data in violation of their Visa agreement. There will then be a breach of that data. They notify the card issuer, the bank, the credit union, who then notifies you that there's a problem with your card. He issues a card, you take whatever actions you may take. The problem for the financial services industry is they get blamed for the security breach, but in fact they are not the source of the security breach. It's the retailer or their processor. The 0304 amendment that we added right off the start here this morning clarified that these third-party intermediaries holding on to the data is also a violation. And it's a expensive, at times, proposition for the financial services institutions. It's also a problem that they are getting blamed for things that are not of their doing. I believe in accountability, and if they're doing bad things, they should be responsible for that. But if they're not doing bad things, they probably shouldn't be responsible for that. And that's what House File 1758 attempts to get to. I have with me two individuals here this morning who will speak to this.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. You state your name for the record, please, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, Representative Dabney. My name is Bill Raker. I'm a resident of Eagan, and I'm president of U.S. Federal Credit Union in Burnsville. I'm here testifying today in support of House File 1758. Card fraud and plastic card losses have become an increasingly large problem for the members of my institution and for all consumers who carry credit cards and debit cards. I've been encouraged by the fact that the credit card industry has come together recently to create unified security standards for how card data is processed and stored. And I'm sure there are some merchants who diligently follow these requirements, but there have been several large-scale breaches where it became apparent that these standards were not being followed. The most recent one was announced in late January of this year, which involved the parent company of TJ Maxx, where over 40 million records were compromised. Many financial institutions in Minnesota were victims of this compromised card database. This impacted my institution by our having to replace over 4,500 cards. The cost to the credit union for just this data security breach alone was over $22,700. For my credit union, card security breaches have resulted in more than $47,000 in losses beyond the cost of replacing compromised cards. In addition to the time, the effort, and the expense expended by the credit union to deal with security breach, there was the limbo state, the confusion, the inconvenience, the anxiousness, and the fear that each of those 4,500 cardholders experienced throughout the process of being informed that their card data had been compromised, that their old card was being canceled and a new one issued, and that they should monitor their accounts regularly and rigorously to determine if any fraud had been committed. The card replacement period can take up to 10 to 14 days, during which time the individual may be without the use of their credit or debit card. I'd like to share just a couple of examples, real stories, that we have heard from our inconvenienced members. One involved a family on vacation when we had to close their cards because of fraud activity. Another case, we had a member who wanted to purchase airline tickets online. We blocked her card for fraud activity on the account, so she was not able to proceed with the transaction. When she went back later to purchase the tickets, they cost her several hundred dollars more. And And finally, we have also had senior citizens who have medication regularly billed to their credit cards, and when the cards were blocked, it interfered with their ability to get access to their medication. One more thing to take note of. The card-issuing institution suffers the loss of the members' trust in the institution and in the security of this delivery channel. Almost always, the cardholder incorrectly blames the issuing institution for the security breach and the inconvenience. And we are indeed hearing from our members that they are losing trust in the credit union over these breaches. All of this, not because of something the cardholder did or did not do, and not because of something the card-issuing financial institution did or did not do, but simply because the merchant and its processor illegally retained data they should not have, and because they did not properly secure it once they had it. This bill does not put into place any onerous requirements for retailers. It simply mirrors the requirements that they are currently obligated to follow. Merchants will still be able to store account numbers, names, and expiration dates. This bill is prohibiting the storage of card security numbers, the three-digit number on the reverse of your card, and PIN numbers, which are really the key to making counterfeit cards and to using stolen card data for phone and internet-based transactions. Currently, Visa and MasterCard standards expressly prohibit the storage of this information subsequent to the completion of the transaction. There appears to be serious laxity in the monitoring and enforcement of those requirements. In addition to preventing the misuse of consumers' card information, this proposed legislation will moderate the impact and cost to Minnesota financial institutions by allowing them to recover expenses associated with reissuing cards when merchants mishandle sensitive account information. Currently, the cost of reissuing cards and expenses related to potential and actual fraud normally all fall on the card-issuing financial institution, regardless of where the breach occurred. The increasing number, frequency, and extent of these card security breaches have brought plastic card security to the forefront as a legislative issue. In the current environment, the exposure to and consequences of such breaches are amplified as paper checks are no longer as widely used or accepted as they once were, and the public is constantly encouraged to use their debit card and their credit card almost exclusively as payment instruments. I think that this legislation is an important and necessary first step towards protecting not just the members of my institution and their information, but that of all of the millions of credit card and debit card users in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Raker. Any questions? Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You've mentioned a couple of times, I've heard in the testimony so far, about lack of confidence in your institution because of this happening. Is there anything here that allows you to tell your customers that we're having to do this because merchant XYZ let your information go? Is there anything in this that says this, or so that they can have confidence that we're just doing this to protect you?
Mr. Raker. Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. It's a good one. The card companies actually do not allow us to communicate to our members where the breach occurred. So we're not permitted to disclose that information. I don't believe there's anything in this bill that addresses that issue.
Representative Nelson?
Okay. I thought I heard that was told to me earlier in my office by somebody, I think from the credit cards, from the credit unions when they were meeting with me earlier. And I guess if I'm a consumer and I find out XYZ company is doing things that are harmful to me, if I knew that it was them that were doing it, I would avoid going to them. But it would be nice if there's a way we could do that, but you say we can't do it because of the credit card
companies won't let you. I understand that, but it's just, it would be interesting if we could figure out a way to do that, because as a consumer, that's the one way we have ultimately to make choices about where we spend our money and our security. If somebody's ripping me off or causing me to be ripped off, I'll just avoid going to that place and shop someplace else.
Thank you. Mr. Raker.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the public does often gain that kind of information from the press, where the release does usually include the name of the company where the breach did occur.
Would you like to proceed? Welcome to the committee, and if you'll state your name for the record, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Kirkland. I am the President and CEO of North Memorial Federal Credit Union, and I am grateful that Representative Daphne has offered this legislation. We have experienced four compromises in the last 10 months. The last compromise caused by TJX, owners of TJ Maxx and Marshalls, involved 100 of our Visa credit cards and 242 of our check cards. This large national compromise caused delays in card production. As my colleague said, over 40 million. Our members waited 9 days for a check card and up to 4 weeks for a Visa credit card. There's significant cost in expressing that card to the member of $25, which we're willing to do when necessary. While these breaches are a burden on financial institutions, the real problem is the real-life issues they create for my members. Most of my members do not have more than one checking account with a debit card attached. These breaches impact their day-to-day activities, especially as more and more merchants no longer accept paper checks. I had one member who is retired, living in Florida on a fixed income. She uses a credit card from North Memorial Federal Credit Union to carry her over until her Social Security and pension checks arrive the first of the month. She had used the last of her cash to do a small home repair and then was without money for groceries for 5 days until we could deliver express her a new card. The member joined the credit union in 1974, and her North Memorial Federal credit card is the only credit card she carries. She was in tears when she called the credit union, not knowing what to do or how to get groceries. In other cases, we had a young gentleman who was in college. He was left with no way to access his checking account. He used strictly his debit card, and therefore no way to get home from school. The credit union rushed a card to him so he could eat and eventually get home. There's also, as my colleague mentioned, the reputation risk. We lost several members during this last incident because they're tired of having their card compromised. They don't understand this is not the fault of the credit union. Besides reputation risk, there was considerable financial loss associated with this compromise. Our reissue costs were over $7,000. We are a much smaller credit than U.S. Federal, and when you think of $7,000 to a credit union with less than 5,000 members, that's significant. Since a credit union is a financial cooperative owned by the members are directly affected by any financial implications as well as the inconvenience. Thank you for looking at this important issue. Thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the panel? Representative Johnson.
Representative Dabney, with TJ Maxx, was there any penalty involved?
Representative Dabney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Guthrie, I cannot speak to that. Perhaps, I don't know if anyone in the audience can speak to whether, you're asking if TJ Maxx was penalized by Visa, I trust, is your question. I cannot speak to that. My understanding is that that is allowable. I'm getting we're at the edge of my understanding here. But
good joining.
I was counting on you.
But I'm not aware, I'm familiar enough with that specific situation to be able to answer that question. I apologize.
Representative Dabney or testifiers, I was concerned at one point. I like to order books. I'm an English teacher, and typically use Amazon when I do so. And I do know that they retain your credit card information so that when you go to purchase something online, you don't have to go through the process of having to continuously reissue your credit card information to them. Has there been issues or are there problems with those very, very large retailers that provide the kinds of goods that we like to order online.
Representative Dabney.
My Mr. Chair, Representative Swales, my understanding is two things. One, in the trade, that's referred to as CVV2 data, which is, you know, the, one of the nice things about being in the legislature is you learn something new almost every day. Recurring transactions, and I think the example you're giving of retailers retaining it for ongoing purchases of an infrequent or sporadic basis, or merchants retaining it for paying your phone bill on a regular basis, you know, a monthly sort of debit on your account. Does holding on to that data actually is prohibited by the agreement with Visa? And I am lucky enough to have the rules for Visa merchants right here. If anyone's having trouble sleeping at night, I can lend them a copy. But it is specific to, you should not store that either on paper or in a database. It's strictly, to quote from it, their statement is, do not in bold, store CVV2 data. This is strictly prohibited.
Representative Swales.
Very interesting. I think I'm going to call Amazon and talk to them. So this really is not only, I mean, this is a federal violation. And when does it leave state jurisdiction and fall into federal jurisdiction?
Mr. Chair, perhaps Mr. Pender could help us with that. It gets convoluted, Representative Swales.
Mr. Pender, is this a federal law, or is this simply policy by Visa and the companies?
Mr. Chair, Representative Swales, it's my understanding that this is simply something that's prohibited by the agreement that the merchants enter into with Visa and MasterCard in order to be you know, part of their network, and that there's not a specific law against keeping the data, either federal or state.
Mr. Pender,
Representative Dabney.
Just wanted to reinforce what Mr. Pender just said. As he was speaking, Mr. Raker and I were speaking, and he reinforced the same thing. There is no federal or state law. It is a function of the contract that the retailer has with the credit card companies.
Representative Swales.
Just food for thought, Mr. Chair, food for thought.
Representative Lane.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding here is that it isn't the credit card number itself. It is the little number on the back that verifies that you actually have access to that credit card, and they are supposed to eliminate that. So they may verify you as a true owner of that credit card at Amazon. They should eliminate that security code, delete it out of anybody's access, but then they could keep the credit card number and continue to do transactions. Is that not correct?
Mr. Raker. Mr. Chair, Representative. Yes, retaining a credit card number and a name and a billing address and an expiration date are not prohibited under our legislation. So it would be permissible to do that. It's the PIN number or the CVV code or the three-digit code on the reverse of the card that is really the major part of the security breach. And while I agree with the representative that it's a convenience to do the transaction with Amazon and Northwest Airlines when they retain the credit card information, it is a convenience, but it is a security breach, and I personally would be happy to re-enter my card number every time I did a transaction with them to prevent something like this from happening. And we believe that this legislation is the first step towards getting some laws on the books that would prohibit the retention of this kind of data. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lane, further questions?
No, thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Is there anyone here who would like to speak either in favor or against this legislation? Please step forward. Welcome to the committee, and if you will state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Buzz Anderson, President of the Minnesota Retailers Association.
You know, if you were going to start a retail store today, you could decide whether or not you wanted to take checks. And as was mentioned, some people are refusing to take checks because it's becoming a real problem as it relates to check fraud and so on. But you don't have a choice about whether or not to accept credit cards or debit cards. It's such a part of the fabric of today's economy, one has no choice in the matter. But as a consumer, you probably don't know some of the intricacies involved in using or accepting credit cards at a store or debit cards. And I won't go into all the detail, but one thing you should know is that it costs the retailer to accept your credit card. They pay a fee to a bank or whoever issues that card. They pay a fee that's called the interchange rate. That's not negotiable at all. It's just raised without question. And I might point out that Senator Christopher Dodd has got a bill in Congress right now to investigate this as part of you know, antitrust. So, you know, retailers just have absolutely no negotiations on that rate. They pay it. Then there's four different rates that they pay depending on whether the card is swiped, whether you take the number over the phone, whether you use the old knuckle buster, you know, where they put the card in this machine and slide the thing across top. We call them knuckle busters. So there's four different rates that you pay, and one of the rates that you might have to pay is a rate based on whether or not you have a preferred card. That might be a card that says you get cash back after so many purchases. That doesn't come from the credit card company. That comes from the retailer. They're paying for that. So they're paying for you to get money back, not the credit card company. So my point is, this is a very expensive process for retailers to use credit cards. I wish there were something else, but we have no choice. Now, I want to get to the point that there may be a reason that you want to keep credit card information. I think Representative to my right here just pointed that out. Part of the reason you keep that information is because you might be in my case where you have a son at college, and we have our credit card number at the pharmacy because he calls in, they mail the prescription to him, and they just don't call us every time. It goes on our credit card account. And we want that process to be able to take place so he gets his drugs on time. Another reason might be if you're in the nursery business and somebody buys something that has a one-year guarantee, a bush or a plant. You know, people don't hang on to receipts or purchase orders very often, and so they come back to the store, they want to get credit for their plant that's now died, and they say they paid for it with credit card. Well, how do we know? Well, we know because we keep those credit card numbers. But let me tell you what happened to one of my members, a well-known family-owned business here in the Twin Cities. They keep credit card numbers for up to 1 year. For 90 days, they keep those active, those credit card numbers active, but they encrypt them. They pay a company to encrypt them so nobody, if they get access to them, can do anything with them. And then after 90 days, it rolls into a database which stays in archive for up to 1 year. That's so that when the people come back and say, I bought this bush and it's now died and I don't have my purchase order, can you look and see how it paid for it? We have a record of that so we can replace that. If in the first 90 days they want to return something, or in fact if they have a problem with identity theft, then in fact we have that person's credit card number. To my knowledge, we do not keep the PIN numbers or the CVC number on the back, you know, which is that security number. But let me tell you what did happen to this member that does that. They went to all the expense to have that name and credit card number encrypted. One of the people that works for the company that does the encryption, a well-known company, had a person steal 40 credit card numbers as he was encrypting the numbers. They didn't know this had happened until they got notified by MasterCard and Visa. And as a part of that notification, they told MasterCard and Visa, you will pay a fine of $400,000. It was not negotiated. It wasn't in court. It was, we're deducting $400,000 from your account. Boom. You just out $400,000. It would put most small businesses out of business. Now the reason, and it's in the contract, most people don't even know it's there. I try to warn my members, look at your contract to make sure you know what you're doing with these credit card numbers because you might get put out of business. But point of fact is, there is already a penalty in place if this information gets out, and that money is to go to the banks that were just here, who said that they have to pay for that that credit card being reissued. Part of that money goes for that very purpose. So I guess my concern is, are we going to be fined twice if, in fact, we ourselves become victims? This brings me to one final point. I'd love to see something in this law that says if you're a retailer and you go to all means necessary and reasonable to protect that data and you yourself are a victim of identity theft, then Visa and MasterCard cannot fine you $400,000 or some amount because you yourself have now become a victim, even though you've done everything you can to prevent that from happening.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Any questions here from the panel? Seeing none, is there anyone else who wishes to speak for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Dabney, would you have a final statement, and would you like to move your bill?
Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to renew my motion that House File 1758 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Members, we spend a lot of our energy trying to get ahead of the crooks, and this is another swing at that big fat ball, and I would appreciate your support. Thank you.
Representative Dabney moves House File 1758 to be passed and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Chairman Dabney, you want us to... Representative Holbrook next?
Yes. That is our last bill, isn't it?
We have two. We have Representative Adams also.
Oh, yes. Let's do Representative Holbrook.
Good morning, Representative Holbrook. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Dabney. And in order to get the bill in the shape that I'd like to discuss, that there is an A1 amendment which would just delay the effective date of the
bill. Representative Gunther, would you like to move House File 287 before the committee?
I certainly would.
Would you also like to...
I would move an amendment.
Thank you very much. Members, Representative Gunther has moved the A1 amendment, which is an author's amendment, for Representative Holbrook. Any discussion to the amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank
you, Holbrook.
Mr. Chair, and this bill is pretty simple and brought to me by Mr. Neumeister. And what I would basically say is that employers of 20 or more employees would be required to provide written notice to job applicants upon hire of the Fair Information Practices Act and their rights as employees to review appeal their employee personnel records. And that would also require a posting of that information as well. And Mr. Neumeister would like to speak to the issue.
Welcome to the committee. Welcome back, I should say, Mr. Neumeister. If you'd please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Rich Neumeister. 18 years ago, the state of Minnesota adopted a law in 181960 through 181966, which basically implements fair information principles for employees. One, you get access to your records. Number two, that if there is something in your record that is something you disagree with or you want out of your record under current law, you can say to the employer, I'd like to have that out. Or two, have some type of agreement with what the wording may be. Or three, you can state your side of the issue. Now, fair information principles is something which I handed to you. Are principles that we have adopted in Minnesota law and federal law in many areas. In Minnesota, we have adopted it with medical records. We have adopted it with insurance records. We have adopted it in the medical records law. We have adopted it in the drug testing law. There are a number of other examples within both federal and state law that we have adopted it. Since 1989, when I described to you was put into law the access to personal records for private employers, we have had a number of laws amended or put into law. One of them is the Employer Reference Bill.
where information about employees can be shared with other employers, prospective employers, without an employee knowing right away. For example, if there's any documentation in a personnel record of illegal acts or various kinds of things like that, that information can be shared. Secondly, with a consent, information about an individual can then be shared from a personal evaluation or all that. A number of employees do not know about the law, the current law, to where they can get access to their personal records. So what this law basically does is say, hey, you've got rights. And be aware that information can go out to your to a prospective employer or to be shared with others, and you might want to be able to implement some of those fair information principles. So that's the bottom thing, is that it will give employees notice about their rights.
Thank you. Representative Colbert.
And Mr. Chair, I see Mr. Hickey here, and I understand he may want to testify in opposition.
Certainly. Representative Hornstein, question?
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chair, question for Mr. Neumeister. Let's say you have something in an employee record that you'd like to change that took place 10, 15, 20 years ago. Are there guarantees that, and it's private information, are there guarantees that as you go into this process, this information won't be released to, let's say, a personnel committee or a board of directors or anything like this? What's the guarantee that if you want to change it and correct the record, then you're not exposing oneself to further privacy infringements?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, in 181.962, in terms of, let's say, if there's a disagreement or with anything, is the employee's position may not exceed, at least if you're given a different point of view, the position statement must be included along with the disputed information for as long as that information isn't maintained in the employee's personnel record. A copy of the position statement must also be provided to any other person who receives a copy of the disputed information from the employer after the position statement is submitted. But now let's say the first one, there's an agreement that, hey, we're just going to take out the information, or we're going to revise the information, and you might say different wording, which might mean different things to different people. If, let's say you revised it, and you used a weaker word rather than a stronger word, and the stronger word ends up getting all over the place, you know, like you were saying, within the employer. If you look at 181.9641 and 181.965, there are remedies to that effect. To implement those rights, retaliation is prohibited. So there, from the old law, if that happens, there are rights to redress those things, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any other questions from the panel? Mr. Hickey.
Mr. Chairman, members, Mike Hickey with the National Federation of Independent Business. I don't know if I'd describe ourselves as an opponent. I guess we just have some concerns about the bill, and I have been talking to the Senate author, and I'll stay in touch with Representative Holbrook about our concerns. But aside from articulating them here today, we're the state's largest business group in terms of entities. We represent about 15,000 members across the state and have a significant member base. Even in urban Minneapolis, we have a member base.
I see the stickers on the doors as I go in.
I'm glad you noticed, Mr. Chairman. Our concern is just simply that this system is going to happen with the posting. And a lot of businesses, you know, we can send out these directives from St. Paul, but they're just not going to do it. And, you know, I can put it in my newsletter, and other groups will put it in their newsletter, and our members don't always, you know, read the newsletters faithfully or read the bulletins. It's just going to be a lot of non-compliance. So I think you just need to, be mindful of that when you pass this kind of mandate. It's albeit a fairly minor mandate, but, you know, it's just not going to get posted in a lot of places. And so, you know, I don't know really what we're accomplishing here. A lot of businesses don't have a break room. Somebody's going to tape this to the wall somewhere. It's just going to be a lot of non-compliance. And I think people keep track. For companies that do document things in paper, I think people hang on to the important documents, your reviews, some kind of reprimand letter that really got under your skin. I think the employee hangs on to that. They currently have a right to review their record. I realize what we're trying to do here is just inform people. But the important things, if paper companies, you know, do use paper documents for these kind of things, they do hang on to the important things. So I guess, you know, just a concern that, you know, you can tell people to put this on a wall in thousands of businesses across the state, but I just really don't think it's going to happen.
Right. Any questions for Mr. Hickey? Seeing none. Representative Helberg, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair, I just appreciate the committee's support. I think that in this day of growing electronic records and the greater ease in sharing information, it's important that individuals know what their rights are relative to information held on them.
With that, members, Representative Gunther renews his motion that House File 2887 be recommended to pass and be, as amended, and be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you for visiting the committee this morning. Members, we're going to stall out for another minute or so as Representative Knuth comes to the plate to cover a bill that she is a co-author on. It will be our final bill for the day and for the session.
Wow.
Yeah.
We're enormously efficient.
Well, I think that's because we're in the... Well, you know, if I could have gotten myself up a little earlier this morning, I should have. You're right, Representative Soils.
No more Friday morning meetings.
I hate to break it to you, Representative Gunther.
I don't know.
Just turn the lights on,
Robert.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You get the light bulb in place.
Staff is already on top of it.
Lucky I declared it out of order. The light, that is.
Representative Curtis, welcome.
Hi.
Good morning, how are you? Good. You are the cavalry for Representative Atkins here this morning. Members, Representative Atkins is unfortunately unavailable due to circumstances outside his control, and Representative Knuth is a co-author on House File 1554 and has agreed to pinch hit. Let's go with that. Since, you know, it's getting to be baseball season. With that, the chair moves that House File 1554 be passed and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. Representative Knuth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is addressing payroll cards accounts being used for people in their employment and payrolls. And my understanding is we're going to have a delete all amendment.
A significant amendment. Ms. Newman.
Mr. Chair, the amendment would be pages 1, 2, and 3, delete section 1. Page 4, line 3, reinstate the stricken language. Page 4, line 4, reinstate the stricken language up to 2007. And then insert after May 31st, 2008. So the effect would be that the current law would remain in effect until May 31st, 2008.
Ms. Newman, would you mind repeating that briefly?
I know.
Well, no, it was just a lot.
Pages 1, 2, 3, you're deleting section 1. Page 4, line 3, reinstate the stricken language. Page 4, line 4, reinstate the stricken language up through May 31st. And then insert after May 31st. 2008.
So the effect is that the current law language remains in effect until May 31st, 2008. And then we'll have to renumber sections of
the amendment title accordingly,
just to be official. Sure. The chair will move that amendment. Any discussion to the amendment? Everybody got it? All right. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Knuth to the bill.
Well, I have a testifier here who can explain the bill more clearly than I can. So.
Good morning, Mr. Kozak. Please state your name for the committee and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andrew Kozak, and I represent Comdata, which is a subsidiary of Ceridian and an issuer of payroll cards. Let me just briefly explain a little bit of the background. First, 2 years ago, the legislature amended the statute which describes what kinds of methods are acceptable in Minnesota for paying workers' wages. Up until there's basically at that time there were three ways you could pay workers: by cash or by check, and that was at the discretion of the employer. The employer could choose either cash or check to pay employees. A third way, direct deposit, was optional. And that was at the discretion of the employee. So the employers could mandate either cash or check, but if they wished, the employee could, if the employer wanted and the employee agreed, they could also do a direct deposit. A fourth way of pay, which came into being because of advances in technology and basically in plastic cards, is through payroll cards. And payroll cards very simply are technically known as stored value cards, but we commonly, around all of us, think of them as debit cards. So instead of giving out a check or cash or direct deposit, particularly if someone doesn't have a bank or a checking account, when you sign up to work, you issued a payroll card, which is just a Visa or MasterCard issued by a payroll card issuer, a bank. And that onto that, when payday comes around, they basically, someone presses a button, and suddenly your wages are on that card. And you spend down that card from the time during the course of a week or a month, and when payroll time comes again, they recharge the card. They put your wages on the card. We went through all this two years ago. Worked out a lot of the details with the Department of Labor, with Legal Aid, with the AFL-CIO, the banks, and others who were involved in this new way of paying folks. Right now, these transactions, these kinds of cards are acceptable and legal in most states. Some states allow them without changing the law, other states change the law. We came to the legislature 2 years ago because the Department of Labor said there were questions about whether it would be legal simply to issue them. And so the result was the law that's in front of you now. Because it was a new thing, it was decided that a sunset should be put on it, give it 2 years to work and see how things went. The Department of Labor, Minnesota Department of Labor, has put out a study that was required by the original law and said basically the law works fine. There were very, very, very few complaints. I think they cited three complaints, two of which were resolved and one of which is still trying to be resolved. Basically, I think the complaints were about, they had to remind employers that this was an optional product and not a, the employer had absolute right to take it on, to refuse it, or even once they had it, to decline it. So I think everyone would admit the law is working without any obvious difficulties. But there's some issues that have come up subsequently about clarifying the law, about what kind of fees are appropriate. We've been working with all the parties have been getting together. We haven't quite come to an agreement. And so given the deadline, it was decided, the parties agreed, to set it aside, set any disputes or any questions aside, ask the legislature, ask you folks to extend the law for one more year and give us an opportunity to resolve everything. We believe this, and I think everyone agrees, that this is a very fine product. It serves a need for people who, not everyone certainly, but for people who don't have bank accounts, or for people who don't have access to a bank and have a card which operates as just like the Visa or MasterCard, American Express card that y'all have in your, or we all use in common ordinary transactions. I should say that, just so you know, that the one feature was important, the worker gets one absolutely free transaction. In many cases, I think in most cases, many of the transactions are free, but one that's absolutely mandated is they need to be able, at every pay period, to withdraw from ATM or the bank, their entire pay for that period. So, in effect, the attempt here was to make this the equivalent of cash. Only it's safer because it's insured. If you lose it or it's stolen, you can have it replaced. You don't have to go to the check cashers. You don't need, when you pay your bills, you can pay your bills with this, your electric bill, your light bill, and so on. You don't have to continually go, as people without bank accounts do, to go and get money orders or go to a friend or relative to give them the money, and then they would send the check in, all those kinds of things. So the positives about this method of payment are far outnumber any of the issues that we are currently trying to discuss. But that's, I guess, how it works, Mr. Chair, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Kozak. Any questions for the testifier? Representative Nelson.
Do the people that receive these cards then get a check stub, a written check stub or paper check stub that tells them how much they made that week? Deductions and all that fun stuff.
That's one of the things we're trying to figure out. They do. There are ways of getting it. It's prescribed in the bill, but the access to that information on an ongoing basis, that's one of the things we're trying to figure out in the details of the there are a lot of details because this is a new program, and those are trying to be worked through. But so far, there have been no complaints about people figuring out where they are available, whether electronically or paper, and also they have ways of knowing how much they have left on the card as the month or week proceeds.
Any other questions from the testifier? Representative Gunther.
I have a friend of mine who owns a trucking firm, and he—that's the way he gives expenses for his over-the-road truckers. Very, very handy, very useful tool for him.
Mr. Kozak.
Representative Gunther's right. In fact, it was the trucking industry that first got into these. It's a method of payment because they had the drivers were on the road and on payday, and it just made their world a lot easier to know that on payday they suddenly had the full pay on the card that they carried. So that, I think, was the original. That was one of the original reasons we had to come, because it was some trucking firms that were doing this and had employees in Minnesota, and the question of the legality of the cards was raised, and that's why we came to the legislature in the first instance.
Representative Nelson.
My earlier question, thank you, Mr. Chair. My earlier question was spawned from last year. Representative Lanning had a bill that allowed public entities to go to a strictly electronic form of a check stub, and as in another committee, I raised a question about was that there are some people that don't have computers, so then they would not have a means of accessing that, and again, that prompts my question of how they're going to get a check stub to tell them how much is in there. Just that's just my concern, and that's why I raised the question.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carter Nelson, the point is well taken, and as far as I know, there is an opportunity to get a written out form, but that's one of the issues we'll get resolved.
Any other questions for Mr. Kozak? Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify either for or against House File 1554? Seeing none, member staff has identified one last amendment, just to clarify, on page 4, line 2, please reinstate the stricken language. Again, page 4, line 2, reinstate the stricken language. And on page 4, line 6, strike section 1 is effective June 1, 2007. Any questions on that amendment? With that, the chair moves that amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Knuth, any last comments?
I think Mr. Kozak
pretty much covered it, Mr. Chair. Excellent. With that, the chair removes his motion, put out file 1554. As amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, thank you very much. That completes our work for this session. It's been an honor to be the chair of this committee. I'm proud of the work that we've done for working families and consumers. The kind of bread and butter issues that I said we'd deal with on the first day that we met. I'm grateful to all the members on both sides of the aisle who've participated. Special thanks to Representative Gunther, the GOP lead. Special thanks also to staff, both our nonpartisan staff, Mr. Pender and Ms. Newman, for their insight and advice, as well as committee staff, Ms. Spouse and Ms. Emerson. Thank you all. With that, we stand adjourned.
Great.